I can't untangle. After walking to my desk caddy on the counter, I grab a pair of scissors.
Whoa, what are you doing? He asks.
I've got a knot that won't come out.
Stop,
he says, strolling over. I continue, snipping the knotted strand.
What the hell?
He towers over me with a bemused expression as I drop the offending snarl of hair into the trash.
I can't believe you did that.
His brows draw together as he stares at me, like I'm a cave woman who's arrived via an interdimensional portal.
That's the way you deal with tangled hair? How are you not bald?
A small laugh sputters out of me. That wasn't a regular tangle. It was a Gordian-type thing.
You're crazy.
What do you know about it? You're a guy.
I had long hair once.
What? I exclaim.
When? Quand j'étais un garçon.
He winks.
When I was a boy. My mom was French. During our nomad years, she let my hair grow wild.
Your mom isn't your grandfather Harrison's daughter?
No, she was. But my family spent a lot of time in Europe. My mom took after my grandmother, who is French. They like long hair on men. At my grandmother's request, I almost grew my hair long again for the campaign.
What campaign? I ask, surprised. Declan is the last guy I could picture with long hair. He is 100% Wall Street billionaire. French bohemian does not compute.
The Rebels Creed campaign. I agreed to be the brand ambassador for the launch. My grandmother wanted me to grow my hair to shoulder length for the ads. That's not me, but I considered it for her.
He runs a hand through his short locks.
In the end, I reminded her the branding was supposed to be all American and long hair wouldn't align. So instead, it was short, wet, tousled hair, like I'd just stepped out of the shower. Hence the towel.
Those ads are total thirst traps, I admit. So the cologne's a family thing? That makes sense. I wonder how they convinced you to become a model. It doesn't seem like you.
He shrugs his broad shoulders. I only love a few people. When one of them asks me for something, I don't say no.
Good for you, I say sincerely. And for them. My fingers trace his six-pack lightly. You still miss your mom a lot?
Yeah. Always.
Cocking my head, I offer him a sympathetic look.
She's been gone a long time, so the grief isn't what it was. But there's a hole that nothing can fill. It stays empty and always will.
I grimace. My dad left us, so there were a lot of angry feelings when he died. But I get a pang every now and then. Like when one of our friends got married and the girl's dad walked her down the aisle, I thought, I'll never have that. My dad will never see our lives play out. And we'll never get to see him again either.
That's it exactly.
He looks away, his expression clouding.
My mother was extraordinary. Everyone says so. It's tragic that she left this world so young.
His thumb rubs his knuckles.
But no one ever promised life would be fair. Everyone has to play the cards they're dealt. The more hardships you face, the harder you have to work to overcome them.
He draws in a long breath, making his muscled chest expand.
And if you're born with a lot of gifts, they shouldn't be squandered. A lot of people in my set wander through life aimlessly. They don't have to work, so they don't. That's a mistake.
He clears his throat.
One day, I'm going to meet my mother again on the other side.
His eyes lose their focus as they stare into the middle distance.
I'll tell her that I thought about her all the time. Especially when I set out to excel at something. I'll say I became the best quarterback in college football to leave our mark on GU.
He blinks and tilts his head, eyes narrowing. His voice softens and is almost wistful.
I want to have a lot of accomplishments by the time I die. So when I see her, I'll be able to say, this is what I did with all you gave me.
I don't even realize I'm crying until he looks at me and his eyes widen.
Hey, he says, pulling me against him in a hug. Hell, sorry. That was overly sentimental. I don't know why I said all that out loud. It wasn't overly anything, at all, I counter, wiping my eyes. Too much, clearly. He rubs my back. Shake it off. I smile. Declan is not someone who is comfortable with big shows of emotion, which I bet is something he gets from the Hayworths, not his bohemian mom or creative French grandmama. His phone buzzes and he checks it. Good. I asked Briggs to drop off some breakfast. He's here. Declan wraps the towel around his waist and goes to the back door. When he answers it, he's back to being Mr. Wall Street. He's pleasant and formal as he accepts two handlebags from Briggs. Declan closes the door with his bare foot and shivers. The temperature dropped. It's a lot colder out there. Sure, the weather changed. Being nearly nude with wet hair has nothing to do with how cold it feels to you. He sets the handlebags on the counter and pauses to look at me.
I don't think anyone has ever been as sarcastic to me as you are.
My lips twitch into a small smile I can't suppress. You're welcome. He rolls his eyes as he takes out sealed containers that are fogged with steam. I hustle to join him at the counter. Opening lids, Declan reveals ham and cheese omelets, a creamy mushroom sauce, several fresh baked croissants, and a jar of cherry apricot jam. After dipping my fingertip into the sauce, I lick it off. Oh my God. I love Briggs so much right now. Declan grabs dishes and cutlery and then plates the food for us, making a swirl with the truffle sauce that looks suspiciously like an H. Did you just monogram the food? He winks at me. My phone chirps that I have an email, and I immediately start over to it.
That can't wait,
Declan asks disapprovingly. He wasn't kidding when he said he wanted me all to himself. But he of all people should understand that sometimes it's critical to check messages. There was an abduction last night. So, of course, GDD will be covering the story, and I want to see the updates. Sorry, just this one, I say lightly. My email only forwards high-priority messages. The email is from Professor Heinrich. And what I read causes my stomach to plummet. Body washed ashore on riverbank. Police believe it's Casanova victim 2. Rickson unreachable. If you go, byline is yours. Available? My finger jabs the reply button and I type a quick message. Yes, where along the river? I have to go out, I say, scrambling to grab a pair of socks and a sweatshirt. The crime scene is being processed. I need to get there quickly. No way, Declan says, scowling. I have you for the day. Rain check on spending the day together, I swear. I rush over and rise up on my toes to kiss him lightly on the lips. Where do you think you're going, Rin? And for how long? It's dispatch business and I have to hurry. I grab my coat and pull it on, adding, I'll fill you in as much as I can later. His frown deepens as I push my feet into shoes and grab my keys. Cameron, later! Rushing outside and down the back stairs, I almost crash into a member of Declan's security team. The guard grabs me, which at first I think is just a reflex, until he doesn't let go. Looking up, surprised, I say, what the hell are you doing? The man ignores me. Sure. My head jerks to look over my shoulder at Declan, who's in the doorway. You can take a minute to answer my question, Cameron, he says. Where are you going? Are you really having me detained in my backyard? Glaring at the security officer with the hatchet face, I snap, get your hands off me. After last night, I'm worried about you, Declan says grimly. Do me the courtesy of putting my mind at ease. Gritting my teeth, I hiss at the silver G.I. Joe. Let go. Declan nods and the man releases me. I whirl to face Declan. I'm going to the river to see a body that's washed up. Tavi? He asks sharply, his face a mask of concern. That softens me up a bit. No, I don't think so. They believe it's an earlier Casanova victim. I'll join you, strictly as protection, I promise. Give me a second. I'm ready to tell him he's not welcome. But then a thought occurs to me. Declan is the campus hero. If he's with me, the police might invite me closer to the action. All right, come, but hurry.
Chapter 39. Declan. When we arrive at the river, I spot Eric standing at the rocky shoreline just outside the crime scene tape. This site is a quarter of a mile from where he lives. I don't see his SUV, so he must have walked over. A uniformed officer, two men in low-quality suits who I assume are detectives, and several personnel in white jumpsuits scan the area and collect evidence.
Is that Eric Sorensen?
Cameron asks.
I wonder what he's doing here.
As soon as the car stops, she climbs out, which causes me to frown. I need to teach her to wait for me to open her door. She's always in a rush when it comes to the newspaper. By the time I get out and walk within a few feet of the taped-off area, Rin's leaning over a metal drum to talk to a cop.
You again, he says to her with a scowl. Weren't you at the Octavia Muniz crime scene?
My eyes narrow. I don't like his tone.
Yes, but I'm not a gawker. I'm a member of the press.
She digs a plastic ID badge from her coat pocket and holds it up. He studies her ID card for a moment before looking up skeptically.
The Granthorpe Daily Dispatch? Seriously? You think school newspaper credentials entitle you to information, Lois Lane? That's enough.
As I stalk over, his eyes widen with recognition.
Declan Hayworth! Fantastic game!
He thrusts out a hand. I shake it, unsmiling. I'm here with Miss Reynolds. Nodding at Cameron, I give him a hard look. Like you, she's here to do a job. You can respect that. Right? His gaze darts to Rin, who smiles at him in a no-hard-feelings way. As usual, she's kinder than I would be. Ask your questions, Cameron, I say.
No worries.
She says lightly and gives me a subtle nudge to back away. I retreat a few feet, but remain close enough to ensure his tone improves. As I wait, my eyes travel to the white plastic sheet that's over the body. A pale, waxy-skinned foot with chipped pink toenail polish is all that can be seen of the dead girl. Jesus. Glancing at the water, I can't keep thoughts of my mom out of my head. Her body never washed ashore. It always bothered me that she was never found, but the pale foot makes me wonder if we were better off. My mom had glowing, sun-kissed skin when she boarded the yacht. She looked incredibly beautiful in the last pictures of her. I wouldn't have wanted to see her skin turn the sickly gray of a beached fish, and I definitely wouldn't have wanted autopsy photos to surface online, which they have a tendency to do in famous cases. For me, she'll always be the stunning 28-year-old in the gold eyeshadow and a vintage sundress who kissed me goodbye as she left. Forever young. Forever beautiful. Forcing the pain back down, I look around, trying to focus on the present. The officer retreats to speak to a colleague, and Cameron takes several surreptitious photographs with her phone. Photos. I grimace at the reminder that she thinks like a member of the press. Eric stalks over. His jaw and his fists are clenched. Cameron joins us, looking up at him expectantly.
Hey, Eric. My name is Cameron Reynolds.
Her voice is gentle as she extends a hand and says,
Are you the one who discovered the body?
He shakes her hand briefly, then glances at the plastic sheet with a scowl.
How'd you hear about this, Cameron? Heinrich?
Her eyes widen.
Yes, actually.
Did you notify the Daily Dispatch? Light blue eyes bore into her.
No. Heinrich has a police source.
I know.
Her brows rise, and she tilts her head.
How do you know that? Are you Rickson?
His head gives a jerk that passes as a nod and sends his wild mane of windblown hair into his face. Shoving it back behind his ears isn't successful, and he turns into the wind to keep it from blowing into his eyes.
Oh my God. I had no idea. None of us did, she says, staring up at him in awe. That's really surprising.
He pulls a black knit hat from a pocket and puts it on, pushing the hair back again. This time, the hat holds it in place.
The CSI team won't get much,
he says, his voice gruff.
Water destroys everything.
His jaw clenches again, like he's about to take on an offensive line. The group of people in white protective gear lift the body onto a gurney and roll it toward a waiting van. Cameron grimaces, shaking her head. So now we know that he is killing them. I knew he probably was, but I was hoping not. Eric's hand covers his mouth and rubs his beard. His voice comes out gruff again, which isn't typical when he's off the field.
He has to be found.
Cameron nods. Agreed. She notices the uniformed officer back at the tape and walks over to ask additional questions. Moving closer to Eric, I eye his scowling face. What is it?
I knew the girl.
He glowers up at the gray sky like he's prepared to chastise the heavens.
I spent a night with her.
She was pretty.
Fit.
Eager to please.
I plan to see her again.
The van coughs out some exhaust. With eyes that are blue lasers slicing through the distance, Eric watches it pull away.
He destroyed her for no reason.
Eric's voice drips with disgust.
If I find him first, I will beat him to death. Slowly.
I incline my head in a nod of silent support. Cameron turns, her hair blowing in the gusting wind, her cheeks flushed. As she talks to the police, she points and speaks animatedly. A part of me is drawn to her like a moth to a burning bulb. Nothing looks better on a girl than passion and purpose. I just wish her passion was directed at something else.
What's the story there?
Eric inclines his head toward Cameron.
You're with her? Or you're done?
The question takes me off guard. Why do you ask?
Shane said it ended. If you're just here to protect her, take off. I'll do it. I could use the company.
My jaw clenches, anger lighting my veins. Are you serious? His gaze cuts to me, glacial blue eyes locking with mine.
Things aren't over?
No, not over.
Hmm.
I don't like the way he looks at her, seemingly speculating on her availability. It's uncharacteristic for Eric. Privately, Shane and I call him the Iceman, since he's had zero relationships since we've known him.
I spent last night with her, I say,
my tone carrying a chill worthy of winter. Without another word, he glances at Cameron, nods and walks away, eventually disappearing around the corner of a building. Sorensen's interest in Cameron sets me on edge. Has he been biding his time? Waiting for the season to end so he'd be free to start something with her? If so, he's too late. Cameron strolls over, looking around. Where's Eric? I want to talk to him. My jaw feels like it will snap in half, but I manage to unclench it. With equal effort, I'm careful to keep my tone neutral. He left. The girl was someone he hooked up with. Casual sex, as per usual, but this was still a shock. Normally, I wouldn't say any of this, but if he's my competition, I don't want Cameron to get the impression he's a brooding, lonely guy who needs a friend. Let her hear instead that he has more hookups than New England has fishing boats. It's true, after all.
Oh, God,
Cameron mumbles, grimacing.
He slept with her? It must have been so awful to find her.
She sounds sympathetic, which makes me scowl. Eric's the one who discovered the body?
Yes,
she says. I grimace. Even a fleeting thought of finding Cameron's murdered body floating in the river turns my stomach. I wish Eric well in his mission of tracking Casanova and beating him to a bloody pulp. Are you done here, Nymph? Her eyes widen at my use of the pet name, which slipped out unintentionally.
Are you okay?
She whispers. I am. Slip of the tongue. How about you? Are you all right? Glancing out at the river, she nods.
Yeah, I'm fine. I didn't get much from the police. Hopefully Eric got more.
Why hope for that? You're competing with him for the story, right?
Well, I was. But I think we may work together again.
After he ghosted you in the past, why would you?
Well, now I realize the reason he probably disappeared was because he was so busy with finals and football. We weren't on deadline for the Dark Knight story, so he probably thought my emails could wait.
My muscles tighten as she continues to give him the benefit of the doubt. With Eric, still waters run deep.
He could believe that his friendship and working relationship with Cameron precedes my involvement with her, making her fair game now. That thought pisses me off so much, I feel like smashing something. He can't have her. No one can. Cameron Reynolds is mine. Chapter 40. Declan. After we reach her place and exit the car, I put my arm around her shoulders, squeezing her in a side hug. I'm surprised it feels so natural. Once inside, she slips her coat off. This morning was important. Heinrich needs to know I'm reliable. Thanks for your support at the crime scene, by the way. That uniformed cop was more helpful after meeting you. Anytime. I lower my head so our mouths are only millimeters apart. Cameron's soft lips press against mine in a kiss that starts sweet and turns sexy. Yeah, this works. I'll run interference all day if the rewards are physical. When my arm slides around her, her body leans into mine. The kiss deepens until my hand squeezes her ass. She pulls back with a small, sharp intake of breath. Things get real very fast with you. Her thigh rubs against my cock, which has gotten hard during the kiss, and her eyes widen. Are you ready for sex again? Her incredulous tone draws a soft laugh from me. Getting hard is a cock's main mission in life. Mine understands the assignment. Her soft laughter joins mine. How do you get anything else done? It's a mystery. That causes her smile to widen. Though I will say things have definitely escalated with you around. My body's response to yours is very consistent, not surprisingly. Her brow arches, not surprisingly. Sex with you is intense and incredible. She tilts her head and gives me a wide-eyed look that causes another wave of lust to roll through me. Even though you have to hold back with me, even though, I say with mock gravity, A smirk teases the corners of her mouth. Beginner's luck, maybe. Her hand presses against my chest. I'm glad it's worked out. Her tone is light, but sincere. This admission from her shouldn't spread through me like warmth from a fireplace, but it does. She's a total siren without even trying. I let silence cover what I don't intend to point out, which is that her innocence is part of the reason I've been so successful at getting exactly what I want from her. She has very few established boundaries. Retreating, she grabs her laptop and takes it to the tiny dinette table that would be better suited to catch keys in a foyer. Declan, can I ask you a few questions as a journalist? I grimace reflexively. Not a good idea. Just for background information, I promise I won't name you as a source. I shake my head, and her expression is resigned. Okay, but that sucks. She sits and lifts her laptop screen. I think you should head out. Head out, I echo skeptically. Yeah, I need to work, and my place is so small. We're right on top of each other. It'll be a distraction. I wish we were right on top of each other. And what the hell happened to our plan to spend the day together? I cleared my schedule to be a shut-in with her in her matchbox apartment. Tell me something, I say. She presses the power button, and her computer plays a few notes to signal it's starting up. Yeah? What would it take for you to change your major? She looks up at me through her lashes. What do you mean? There must be some other fields that interest you. What would it take from me to get you to pursue something else? You're joking, right? I turn up a palm and lean forward. When there were no women pursuing degrees in engineering, the university offered scholarships to female students. The number of girls majoring in chemical and electrical engineering rose significantly. She stares at me with a confused expression. Are you saying you want to pay me to change careers? It's an option. Journalism has never been lucrative, and it's a dying profession. My being involved with an investigative reporter isn't sustainable. There are conversations I can't have with you while you're acting as a member of the press. You could still be a writer, just a different kind. Smoothing the front of my shirt, I study her. She doesn't look pleased. You understand the problem, right? Declan, I don't have to do stories about you. What about when I am the story? She straightens up, her expression hardening. Are you Casanova? Of course not. Then you are not the story. I know it may be difficult for someone such as yourself, an egomaniac who is worshipped like a god, to understand this, but the entire universe doesn't revolve around you. Egomaniac. I am legitimately trying to find a way to make things work. Given the number of times I've had to remind her of the NDA, her dismissive denial of the problem is outrageous. And what the fuck is up with her condescending tone? So you think I'm exaggerating when I say that aspects of my life may intersect with your stories, I demand. You are so fucking naive sometimes. In bed, that works for you, but otherwise, no. The truth is, I already have pieces of information you don't, because I have access to circles you never will. It's not ego, it's a fact, and I can't bring you farther into my world if you can't be trusted. She looks as if I've torn her heart out and stomped on it. My tone wasn't harsher than hers, but she may not be used to this type of cold, hard honesty. You should go, she says softly. I'm not leaving. If this affair is going to work, affair. She leans back and folds her arms across her chest. Is that what this is? Blowing out a breath, I scowl. Look, I'm not trying to make you feel unimportant, which makes it even worse. It's not a conscious thing. Your entire existence is designed to make other people feel less important. She licks her lips. Why are we here instead of Hayworth House, Declan? This place is a sardine tin compared to yours. You can't be comfortable here. Why have Briggs bring you a care package this morning when your place is 10 minutes away? The arrangement is over. You can't live with me. I can't live with you? Or I can't come to your house anymore? Earlier, you said you were tempted to sneak me back in. What's really going on? I don't want to get into this right now. Hayworth House is real estate that's owned by my family, not me personally. Someone found out I was staying with you and told you to bounce me? Who? It doesn't matter. Yes, it does, since you're following orders. It wasn't an order from Brock Stowe, of course not. Are we even dating? Or is this quote-unquote affair a secret? Initially, being discreet makes sense. I have to be sure this relationship is going to last long enough for it to be worth a battle with my family. She shoots to her feet. Get the hell out of my apartment. Rin. Come on, do not call me Rin. What the hell kind of bullshit nickname is that? Cammy is a 6-year-old girl in pigtails. She rolls her eyes, then use Cam. You don't get to rename me to suit your own tastes. I purse my lips. What's wrong, Declan? Cam's not fancy enough for you? Rin's more like Ren, which sounds like the name an heiress would have? You are so fucking heavy-handed. You don't even ask if it's okay to call me something totally new. You just do it. Let's not get melodramatic. Do not tell me how to act. I don't work for you, and I'm not yours to order around anymore. She looks at me with a wintry chill in her normally warm eyes, which irritates me even more. Gritting my teeth, I glare at her. Lower your voice, Cameron, and watch your tone. Her head tilts, and her eyes narrow. Why? Are you afraid your armed guards will hear me yelling at you? She deliberately raises her voice on the last 4 words. Are you going to call them in to subdue me? Is she fucking kidding right now? Enough already! Stepping forward, I tower over her. I don't need anyone's help to handle you. Now lower your fucking voice. This isn't some white trash reality show. She jerks back and starts to stalk away. I grab her arm, and she whirls and punches me, her fist banging into my pelvic bone. The blow was supposed to hit me farther below the belt, literally. Grabbing her arms, I pin them behind her back. There will be none of that. Within my chest, my heartbeat is like fists banging on a locked door. You do not want to turn this physical. I will punish you. No, you will not, she snaps. You put hands on me first. She struggles to pull free. Let go. Settle down, I bark. She flinches, and warning bells sound in my head. Do not let this escalate any farther. Shut it down now. My heart hammers as I force myself to release her. It's not what I want to do. Deep down, I want to spank her into submission and then fuck her. She rubs her wrists while glaring at me. Now get out. Clenching my jaw, I shake my head. No. In the distance, the voice of reason is trying to tell me something. I can't hear it. There's one thought rolling through my head. She's mine. Cameron stalks toward the door. I beat her to it and put my palm against it so she can't open it. She slaps her palms against my chest and tries to push me. I hold my ground. You're a fucking hellcat sometimes, I rasp. You can't win a physical fight with me. Give it up. My breath comes and goes from my lungs in a staccato rhythm, and my pulse pounds in my ears. She stares at me, her gaze darkening as a terrible silence descends. Finally, my heartbeat slows, and the black rush of battle fades. Fuck, I whisper. Then I point to the edge of the bed. Sit down. Let's talk. I hold out my hand. Slapping my hand away, she shakes her head. Blowing out a slow breath, I can still feel my heart thudding like a drum. I can't believe the way she gets under my skin. What the fuck am I going to do with this girl?
Are you done holding me prisoner?
Cameron, I scoff.
If so, please get the fuck out.
Her voice lacks heat, which only makes it more ominous. She's right. I should leave to give her time to cool off. But I don't want to. We should talk this out. I hear myself say,
there is no talking this out.
Cameron says, her voice rising again. You and your whole family can fuck off with your holier-than-thou bullshit. I was a virgin when we met. You're the man-whore who's into deviant sex. She lets that land to vicious effect. It causes fury to course through me, but I don't rise to the bait. We're on dangerous ground. Control is slipping from my grasp again, and I have to fight to hold on to it. Cameron can clearly see the landmines, too, and she's determined to set them off because she continues. Your uncle's a total creeper. His wife is a cold bitch with a stick up her ass, and I'm sure your dad and grandparents are assholes, too. Her eyes narrow and glare at me again as she speaks. So don't you dare ask me to give up my dreams for the chance to be your dirty little secret again, while you decide if I'm worth it. Because your family doesn't approve of me, I've got news for you. The feelings of disapproval are mutual. And frankly, you would have been lucky to fucking have me. I would have cared about you in ways you and your cold-blooded family can't even comprehend. She pushes my hand off the door, and this time I let her. Now leave, Declan. I can't stand to be near you another minute. She jerks the door open, steps back, and points. Internally, rage courses through me. I want to slam the door closed to keep fighting. But as the black haze starts to descend, I know it's time to go. I stalk out. Standing in the yard, I let the cold air wash over me, trying to hold everything inside me before I explode. My coat and keys fly out the door a second before it slams. After a moment, I retrieve them from the grass and pull on my coat. My mind is so full of our fight that I don't remember walking to my car or the drive home. When I'm in Hayworth House, I dismiss Briggs for the night and lock the front door. I want to be alone. Which I now am.
Chapter 41. Cameron. When the tidal wave of fury subsides, I find myself sitting on the edge of my bed, feeling shaky and sick. My apartment feels hollow, so does my chest. What the hell just happened? Tears sting my eyes, which infuriates me. I will not cry. He is not worth the fucking salt. And yet, tears well up and spill over my lashes. God damn it! I did the right thing, 100%, without question. But it still hurts. So much. I wipe the tears away impatiently. Pull yourself together, Cammy, right now. Because this sick relationship with him had to end. It's toxic. I draw in a broken breath. I know I'm right. Declan will always treat me like I'm less worthy. He can't help it. His arrogant family and the world have trained him to believe that a girl should give up anything he asks. Her career, her family, her dreams, for any chance to be with him. Even as a mistress. Which is what he clearly wants me to be. Fuck that.
I just wish I hadn't let myself care about him. It's going to take some time for me to put this behind me. Flashes of our fight come roaring back. I hold my head, rubbing my temples. I've never been as angry and out of control as I am during fights with him. It's unbelievable. I shudder. It's over. Let it go. What should you be doing? Take a breath and think. Octavia Muñiz has been kidnapped. A dead body washed ashore. The student body needs to know what's happening. Someone may even have information that will help the investigation. I need to work. To try to make a difference and do some good. Declan believes you won't be able to get information without him. Prove him wrong. He is wrong. Being born with a silver spoon has nothing to do with making headway as a journalist. All investigative reporters begin as complete outsiders and dig their way into stories people are trying to cover up. Sometimes, the people we investigate are the most powerful men in the world. Who try to close ranks. Who act like they're unstoppable. But that's just what they want everyone to believe. It's not true. Watergate. Pedophile priests. Weinstein. A media spotlight can change the world. And for me, that's the mission. Rubbing the back of my neck, I nod to myself. Eden and Aria were holding things back while talking to the police last night. I bet I can get them to open up to me about Tavi if I talk to them alone.
Declan. For 3 hours, I sit alone in the dark, drinking cognac and checking each text that buzzes my phone. I don't open them. I'm too furious to speak to anyone. The only person I would speak to is her, even though I know the bitter fight would only rage on if I did. Cameron doesn't text, and she doesn't call. We are finished. I say the words out loud a few times to let them sink in. Cognac sloshes over the sides of the glass as I pour. My coordination's off. I'm drunk. Good. It should help me reach the point of not caring about a fucking thing. Finished. Raising the glass, I gulp down another burning swallow. Cameron, Reynolds, and I are finished.
Cameron. It takes me half an hour to get the phone numbers I need. I call Aria first, and she picks up, which surprises me. I thought I would have to leave a message requesting a callback. Hey, Aria, it's Cammy Reynolds. Are you free to talk? Not really. What's up? Before the police arrived last night, you said something I've been wondering about. You were talking to Eden, and you said Tavi was taking trips to the city to hook up with someone. A sugar daddy? Tapping my pen against the table, I lean forward, waiting. Her silence causes me to press on. Can you elaborate? Who was she going to see? When I said that, I didn't realize you were on the school paper. So here's what I'm wondering. I continue, as if she hadn't shut me down. I think some of the male alumni find ways of convincing young women to visit them in Boston, in exchange for financial help, or even help with the GU admissions process. I'm taking a stab in the dark based solely on my own experience with Brock Stowe and the seemingly well-oiled machine that was in place to get me into GU and checked for diseases by a sketchy doctor. There was also the doctor's slip that a nighttime off-the-books examination was part of some process for girls to pay off their debts to a secret group of men. No comment, Aria says. I'm surprised she doesn't just hang up on me. Octavia definitely isn't the only girl who was groomed for that, I say. Someone close to me was nearly tricked into a position that would have made it hard for her to escape. Fucking assholes, Aria murmurs. So is that the story you're working on, not Casanova? I wonder if the two things could be related. Maybe I'm working on a single story. At this point, I'm not sure. Aria huffs a small breath into the phone. Who is Rickson? Are you working with him? It's a guy, right? That catches me off guard. It is a guy. I'm not officially working with him, though we do exchange research. I want to meet him. Now I understand why she hasn't hung up. She has her own reason for taking my call. May I ask why? I say. There was something buried in one of his stories I need to ask him about. I want to find Tavi, and the police seem to have their heads up their asses. They can't even say if Daniel Take actually was Casanova. Why the hell not? They were asking guys to submit DNA, so they must have some of Casanova's to compare. It's been days. By now, they should be able to fucking tell us if Avery Kershaw killed Casanova or not. Her voice has become loud and animated. I rise and start to pace. This conversation energizes me. So listen, she says, if you can arrange the meeting, I'll work with you. That's assuming you're not out to trash Tavi in your story. She's one of my best friends. If you're planning to slut-shame her, I will fucking kill you. I'm not out to slut-shame anyone. Victim blaming is against everything I stand for. I'd never do it. Pressing my lips together, I nod my head, which of course she can't see. Let me reach out to Rickson to see whether he's open to a meeting. Yeah, do that. I'll talk to you soon, Aria. As soon as the call ends, I send an email to Eric Sorensen, asking him to call me and providing him with my cell number. Next, I try to call Eden Buchanan, but I go directly to voicemail. Hi, Eden, this is Cameron Reynolds. If you have a minute to talk, could you please call me back? After a beat, I leave my phone number. Chewing on the end of my pen, I wait. Aria's concern about Tavi being slut-shamed convinces me I'm on the right track when it comes to Tavi's city trips. Which makes me wonder whether Brock Stowe is behind the sex for money / college admission scheme. If so, and if it were revealed, it could be embarrassing for the entire Hayworth family. Maybe that's why Declan is trying to steer me away from journalism. A twinge of unease surfaces. I never intended to publish an article that could hurt Declan. And actually, this story hits too close to home for me as well. The trouble is, it may not just be a college sex scandal. If Tavi's extracurricular activities made her a Casanova target, that needs to be uncovered. The phone rings, and it's an unknown caller. Eden or Eric? I swipe to take the call. Hello?
It's Sorensen.
The background noise sounds like I'm on a hands-free speaker while he's driving. I press the phone closer to my ear. Hi, Eric. Is this an all right time to talk?
Unclear. Did Hayworth okay it?
My brows rise and I purse my lips. I didn't ask Declan's permission to make a phone call to a colleague. Why would I? Listen, I've been speaking with a source about the Octavia Muñiz abduction, trying to get some background on her. My source would like to meet S. Rickson. I didn't tell her it's you. By the way, she's a member of the dance team, so you probably know her. Aria Peralta? How would you feel about a meeting?
The Octavia Muñiz disappearance is a non-starter. She wasn't abducted.
What? Are you sure?
Yeah.
My mind reels. If her own closest friends, like Aria, don't know this, how does Eric Sorensen? I don't have time to process his revelation before he continues.
So, no. Not interested in meeting a source on Muñiz.
He clears his throat.
Next time you call for a meeting, check with Hayworth first.
Why the hell would I do that? Even if Declan and I were dating, which we are not and never were, I wouldn't need his permission to meet with someone.
Opinions on that differ.
Eric, I snap, you're mistaken. Declan doesn't expect me to check with him about anything. And no one in my life would ever have that right anyway. The work is the work, period. After a beat, he says,
goodbye, Reynolds.
The call ends, and my brain feels ready to explode. I'm relieved Tavi Muñiz is safe. But I can't enjoy the moment because I'm so pissed that Eric Sorensen thinks I need clearance from Declan to speak to people. Has Declan been cautioning people against confiding in me? If so, no wonder he thinks I'll never get inside information.
since he's using his billionaire football demigod status to prevent it. Fucking bastard. I will not let him get away with sabotaging me.
Chapter 42. Declan. The knocking on my front door is loud enough to rouse me from the semi-stupor I find myself in. Smoothing down my shirt, I walk to the door and glance at the camera to find Shane and a girl on my step. For half a second, I think it's her. Pulling the door open causes me to sway. I have to grab the door frame with my left hand. "Hey, hey, Dec," Shane says. Squinting into the darkness at Shane's companion, I recognize her as Avery Kershaw. "What are you doing?" I ask. "I'm standing on your front step. Back up. Let us in," Shane says. "I don't... not interested in seeing you two together. At all. Right now. No fucking way." "What?" Shane says, scowling and giving me a push. I backpedal with one arm windmilling to keep my balance. Shane's hand shoots out and grabs me to slow me down as I crash into the wall. "Oh my gosh," Avery gasps, following Shane into my house and closing the front door behind her. With a palm against the wall to steady myself, I say, "Look, I don't want company right now." "You called me, man," Shane says. Freezing, I stare at him. "Did I?" My brows knit. And then my attention turns to Avery, who is trying to take a duffel bag strap from Shane's shoulder. "Hang on, baby, I've got it. Deck, pick a room. Front room, kitchen, wherever, and have a seat. Avery's gonna get settled into a guest room." Shane starts to lead her to the French guest room. "No," I bark. "That's hers."
"Her who? Cammy?"
"Don't call her Cammy, it's a fucking baby name." I exhale a puff of anger. "But don't call her Rin either. She'll be fucking furious." Avery pushes her big black-framed glasses up her nose and stares at me with giant blue eyes that make her look like a Japanese manga character.
"Did you guys have a fight?"
My ears are ringing at a low hum. "What are you doing here? Who drew you?" Shane steps into my line of sight, blotting out everything else. "All right, none of that. Pick your spot, Deck." "War room." I nod toward the stairs. "Fucking war room."
"Library it is,"
Shane counters, putting a hand on my shoulder and squeezing until I jerk free of his grip. "She broke into the war room. Did I tell you?"
"Nope."
"Yeah. Rin can be dangerous. You wouldn't know it to look at her." I weave down the hall. I know the floor is level, but it feels tilted. I drag my fingers along the wall to gauge myself and stay upright. Once I'm in the library, I realize my mistake. I stare at the water nymph painting until I feel like retching. "I'm gonna take this down. Grab the other end." "Nah," Shane says, turning me to face him and shoving me. I crash land into a sitting position on the sofa. "Stay down, Deck. I'll be right back." "Why did you bring her?" I whisper. "Don't you know I don't want to? I brought Avery because I don't leave her home alone. Casanova's on the loose." "You will, though. You'll have to. School starts soon. She's in the dorm, so... what can you do?" Shane pauses.
"Avery lives with me, Deck."
"All the time?" He laughs.
"Yeah, that's what it means to live with someone.
Not always. Can be a temporary thing. Wasn't it supposed to be in your case? Yes or no?" His frown is as dark as midnight.
"You know what? I think you should sleep this shit off before we talk.
Want to do that here, or should I help you get up to your room? Mine was a temporary thing. Live-in nymph." My index finger swirls in the air, and then I stretch my arm out to tap the painting's frame. "My mistake was relocating her out. Yeah, you can't let them slip out. Fucking Zeus, though." I frown. "That's what he was like with his fucking directives. I never should have listened." Shane watches me, his gaze flicking up to the painting and then back to my face.
"Zeus, who's that?"
The static in my head grows louder, as though I've got my ear against an old shortwave radio. "Harrison." He convinced me. Now everything's unraveled. Fine with him.
In the past, he's always used my mom as a cautionary tale. I didn't think I was like her, but maybe I am. Rubbing my forehead, I blow out a breath. I could fucking be.
Hey, you got the best from both of your parents. I wouldn't call that a fair, a cautionary tale. Not for a fucking second.
Shane's the only person I've ever told about my mother's affair with a married Irish soccer star. It's a well-guarded secret in our family. I think about it a lot, though, since her ongoing contact with my biological father was probably what got her killed. My jaws clench as I think about the night she died. It always hits me the same goddamn way. I almost told Cameron the truth. With her, things were said. Because I said them. I wouldn't normally. Running a hand through my hair, I lean forward.
Look, I'm gonna need your help with something.
What's that?
Sorensen. He can't touch her.
He won't.
Yeah, he might.
He looks at her. My teeth grind against each other. I like him. Sucking on my lower lip, I shake my head. But I will kill him, for fuck's sake, Deck. Shane says with a grimace,
don't move.
I'm coming back. I shrug.
Whatever.
Under his breath, he says,
Christ.
What time is it? I mumble, holding my head to keep my brain from spilling out through my ears. When there's no answer, I kick Shane's boot.
What?
He murmurs without opening his eyes. I asked the time. Shane opens his eyes to slits and presses a side button on his phone.
4:40 in the morning.
Blowing out a breath through pursed lips, I grimace. I feel like hell, I'd imagine. Turning from my side onto my back, I stare up into the darkness.
You didn't let me call her,
did you?
Nope.
My fingers find my forehead, and I rub it.
It's over.
My voice is so soft I don't think Shane hears me, until he offers a sarcastic reply.
Yeah, right.
I think it is. Running my hand through my hair, I fall silent for a moment. I couldn't turn things. Normally, when a situation is unfolding, I know how to get control. The correct strategy always comes to me, usually within seconds. During the fight with her, I could not think straight. I said some things.
Fuck.
When have you ever known me to get into a yelling match with anyone?
Never.
Fucking wrecked. Resting my hand over my eyes, I frown.
You can go, Shane.
I'm all right.
It's morning now, man, and I've been up all night. I want a Briggs breakfast for my trouble.
That makes me laugh, which, in turn, makes my head pound. After a moment, the levity fades, and my mood crashes and burns again. My hand rises to touch the painting's frame, and my fingers trace the grooves.
I don't want to want this girl.
I know, man. Shane says.
I've been there.
Chapter 43. Declan. I sleep off my hangover for about 6 hours. After a shower in cold water, I feel vaguely like myself. I dress in jeans and a night sweatshirt. As I'm zipping the jeans, I can't help but think that Cameron would appreciate the casual clothes. Too bad she won't see them.
Don't. Fucking go there.
Downstairs, Briggs greets me and informs me my guests left at 9:30. The fact that I didn't say goodbye to exiting visitors is a breach of Hayworth House protocol. The world has gone to hell. Coffee and toast, I say, sitting on the bench in the breakfast nook. I grimace as I unlock my phone. It's noon and I have 140 unread text messages. I scroll through the list. There is nothing new from her. Drawing in a deep breath to brace myself, I open the call log to see what damage I may have done. The log shows that during my drunken haze, I called Shane twice and Eric once. Frowning, I set my teeth against each other. The Shane calls I don't care about. He was here after I made them, and nothing I say while drunk could impact our friendship anyway.
The call to Eric, however, is unfortunate. I can't remember a thing I said, but I know where my head was. And unlike with Shane, Eric and I don't share a friendship that stretches back to childhood. He may be pissed. Or worse. One name doesn't appear in the most recent part of the call log, and thank Christ for that. I'm shocked that I didn't call Cameron. And the relief I feel over that one victory allows me to sit back and close my eyes for a few minutes.
You toast and coffee, sir,
Briggs says. My stomach feels like I've been chugging bleach and rat poison. Black coffee would not be a good addition. So I add milk and sugar to the brew. I slather some preserves over the toast and eat slowly. Excessive drinking isn't typical for me, and I haven't felt this hungover since the summer after high school graduation. A fine sheen of sweat forms on the back of my neck as my body fights to right the ship. I wipe the sweat off with a napkin. For fuck's sake. When I glance up, I find Briggs surveying me with concern. I grab a glass of spring water as I leave the kitchen, sipping it as I head down the hall. It's best to deal with trouble head-on, which is what I intend to do. Sitting in the front room, I bring Eric's number to the surface and tap the call icon.
Sorensen,
he says in a low, gruff voice when he answers. Hey. I pause to see whether he'll start us off. No such luck. Predictably, he waits silently. Are you on campus? I ask.
No, New York.
I wait a beat. And?
No sign of Stowe.
The plan was for Eric to do a low-key stakeout of my uncle's residence to see whether he was in town.
I talked to the doorman,
he says.
Lizzie Hayworth was in town for a night, but left again yesterday. Brock Stowe hasn't been in residence for weeks. I went by his office, same story. Not physically on site for the past month. I got the impression he's usually in touch with his secretary every day, but hasn't been for the past few.
What reason did he give for being at his office?
Said I wanted to interview him for a GDD piece on prominent GU alumni, flashed my dispatch ID.
It's a decent ruse. Is the name on the badge Sorensen or Rickson?
Rickson.
Good. I rub my thumb over the denim covering my knee. Direct questions were clearly a more efficient way to go. There's a risk to it, but it seems relatively small. His silence is bleak. Since you've settled the question of whether he's in New York, why don't you come back today?
Yeah,
is all he says. Rubbing the bridge of my nose, I frown over what I need to bring up next. When I called you last night, I was blackout drunk. Eric makes a non-specific sound of recognition as the noise of a city street becomes louder in the background. He's walking outside. I can't remember anything that was said, I admit. There's silence. He could teach a fucking masterclass in its use. If I said things that were out of line, I apologize. After a beat, he says,
"All right."
Blowing out a breath, I shake my head silently. He's not interested in confirming or denying that I was off the rails during our conversation. Well, I'm not interested in dragging it out of him either. Safe travels on the drive back. Another non-specific sound, and he ends the call. I lower the phone with a grimace. I'm pretty sure his silence speaks to the fact that our friendship is no longer solid. Fuck.
Cameron. The byline of the top story in the Granthorpe Daily Dispatch belongs to S. Rickson. I was working on copy when Heinrich emailed to say that Rickson submitted a piece on the body that floated to shore, and that his article would run. I feel a twinge of regret that I took too long to submit mine, but I can't be angry that Eric was the one to get the front page. He knew her. He found her. He deserves to tell the story. Leaning forward, I begin to read. Body of missing co-ed discovered. Isabel Long, who intended to major in economics, ate 2 Skittles per hour during all-night cramming sessions. She passed them around to study partners, saying she used to eat chocolate-covered coffee beans until a rapid heartbeat made her abandon the practice. On October 12th, the morning after Isabel disappeared,
7 brightly colored Skittles dotted the dirt alongside a walking path between the library and her dorm. 2 feet from them lay a pale purple rose. The sight, captured in photos of the scene, haunts many. On December 30th, the Tyne River delivered Isabel's body to a rocky shoreline, where it was discovered at 7 a.m. External signs of trauma were evident. Some of her injuries may have occurred post-mortem while she was adrift. Others happened before she died. A female student who was early to the scene of the discovery said, "So now we know that Casanova is killing them." At the time of her death, Isabel Long was 19 years old. The story continues on the following page, and I read to the end. Afterward, I lean back in my chair. Eric put me in the story but left himself out. As someone who knew Isabel intimately, he had much more right to be there than I did. Heinrich let him bury the lead, which surprises me. I think I know why Eric chose to open the article like a feature, and why Heinrich allowed it. Eric wanted to make Isabel's life and tragic death the story, not Casanova using the river as a dumping ground for one of his victims. I glance back at the article. Eric never uses the words dumped or discarded. He never refers to her body as it. The only time he mentions Casanova is in the quote. And Eric doesn't disclose that Isabel's body was nude. The police officer on the scene mentioned several times that her body was naked. People usually include that detail, and newspapers always do. It's often right in a story's headline. Eric used a different approach, and I'm positive that was intentional. GDD's article humanizes Isabel and allows her as much dignity in death as is possible. For her traumatized family and friends who will read it, this is perhaps the best we could do. Chewing on my lip, I back away from my laptop and close it. I will read every word written about Isabel Long and will attend every candlelight vigil. And in between those moments, I will keep working. I must. The state of decomposition wasn't advanced, which means when Casanova dropped Isabel into the water, she was either dying or freshly dead. So Casanova himself is alive. And he held Isabel for weeks before killing her. The girls who are still missing could be alive too. I need to believe they are. And I need to do everything I can to help bring them home.
Chapter 44. Declan. Entering Eden Buchanan's living room is like stepping into Van Gogh's Starry Night. The walls are twists of vibrant blue with halos of neon yellow. Lying on the couch like a piece of art herself is Tavi Muniz. She wears a blue silk nightshirt, but the halos around her eyes aren't yellow. They're dark and smoky. I've come to Eden's to talk to Octavia.
Hey, Declan.
Tavi murmurs, burrowing into the pillows and throw blankets like a small animal.
Go to the bed.